in a series at the beginning of Genesis. Before we get into the real details of Genesis 1, we thought we'd ask some hard questions for all of this type of issue. If you were with us last time, we asked some hard questions for evolutionists. Today, we've got some hard questions for creationists. Because when we take a look at Genesis 1, 2, and 3, it's not easy for anyone trying to determine exactly how to make this fit into the world around us. Today, Steve, we're going to go into some questions for people probably a little closer to home. These are questions that I'm not sure everybody has thought through. That's why, again, we don't purport to have answers to all of these. We're just trying to purport that to be careful with the text, it's not always easy.
Now, Glenn, why should our audience even care about these things? Why shouldn't they just go ahead and skip these two sessions and go right into Genesis 1:1? I've heard that before. It says, how does this relate to me and why should I even care about all of this?
The reason is because this whole issue of how science impacts the first part of Genesis causes people to walk away from the faith. There's people, well-meaning people within Christianity that present one particular view. Then when they bump into another one, people throw out their entire faith because of that. I've met, you've met, probably we've all met people that significantly struggle with these questions. And some of them say, oh, when I found such and so was not the case, then I threw the whole Bible out and walked away. I saw a well-meaning young earth creationist speak to a high school group. And over the course of a 45-minute lecture, first of all, he was giving the same old things that were talked about 40, 50, 60 years ago and weren't current. Secondly, over the course of 45 minutes, he called the people that teach evolution in universities, he called them ignorant, he called them liars, and he called them dishonest in those exact words. That works with 16-year-olds, but 3 years later, when they're 19, when they're now in sophomore geology class or sophomore biology class, they find out these people aren't quite so ignorant after all. Actually, they're quite smart, and they're no more honest or dishonest than the average people in the population, including the people that lead churches. There's honest, well-meaning evolutionists out there that are just looking at the data. But what we have to do is give people, okay, there's well-meaning Christians that have spent quite a long time thinking these things, and our faith doesn't rise or fall with the age of the earth. It just doesn't.
That's why it's important to us, because there are many Christians, I would count myself in that, that when you have challenges, we have a deep understanding and firm foundation in Scripture and our faith. We have looked at these in the past, and we're not going to be swayed from our faith by them. But there are others that will be swayed by it. And so having this knowledge, you'll be able to help other people who might be considering from walking away from their faith. There are three questions, and I want to give credit to a person by the name of Frank Turek with crossexamine.org to ask somebody when they come to you with certain questions or certain ideas that they have. The first question is, what do you mean by that? To get them to tell you what they mean and what they're talking about. Then the second question is, how did you come to that conclusion? And let them give you the evidence that they say formulated that idea. And then the third one is, well, have you considered? While these things might not necessarily be something for your particular faith, they are something to have a knowledge base or at least a way to go back and listen to some of the things that we put forth here to help other people and other Christians, new Christians especially, that are being approached by these non-believers and skeptics and critics to help them to answer the questions and to retain their faith.
I've just seen too many people walk away from the faith because of these kind of questions, and it doesn't have to be so. We will never answer all questions. We have an infinite God, and we have finite people, and finite people will never understand an infinite God. One of the things we're trying to do with these two or three four sessions here at the beginning of Genesis is to tell our audience, any way you go with this, there's some deep questions. You're going to have to wrestle with the text, and you're going to have to wrestle with some of the things in the world. It happens with all of this. Last time we had hard questions for evolutionists. Today we've got hard questions for creationists. One of the things that we're told, especially by our young earth brothers and sisters, is that if we look at Genesis 1, that we need to take the normal use of the language. We're told that the word day, Hebrew word yom, means day. And evening and morning, the normal use of the word is a day, a 24-hour day. I would agree. And if we view anything else, then we're bringing in information from outside. One of the, I think, unjustified criticism is that, oh, if you go into science and you get information and bring it back to the text of Scripture, that that's illegitimate, that you should instead start with the Scripture and then go interpret the science. And I'm going to demonstrate why that's a flawed answer, because we all do the same things. We all have to have some things from the text and some things from the world to come to a conclusion about the text. Let me give an example to show that. Again, don't lose the criticism here. The criticism is that the normal use of the word evening and morning and the normal use of the word day is that we're forced to have a literal 24-hour day because the text says that. You can't bring anything from the outside. That I've heard that over and over and over. There's many passages in the Old Testament that have language that we have to interpret. For example, Isaiah 55:12 says, "The mountains and the hills shall sing for joy, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands." With that, if we just take the text of Isaiah 55:12, and that's just an example, there's many of these in the Old Testament. Well, every word in that sentence is the normal use of the word. Mountain means mountain, hills mean hills, joy means joy, trees mean trees, clap means clap, hands mean hands. But how do we know that sentence is poetic and figurative and not literal? We go out into the world and we look at a whole lot of mountains and hills, and we look at a whole lot of trees, and we say, golly gee whiz, I've looked at a whole lot of mountains and none of them sing like a human sings. I've looked at every tree in the forest and not one of them has hands. Therefore, this is poetic. I take the science that I did out in the world and I bring it back to the text and I say it has to be figurative because the world around me, the science, if you will, tells me hills can't sing and trees don't have hands to clap. Therefore, it's using some sort of a figurative phrase that still has meaning. It's saying that creation is joyful for the point it's making in the passage. Same thing over in Genesis and every other passage for that matter. If we look at days in Genesis 1, we can't just say day means day and evening means evening, and I'm going to go interpret the world that way. We have to look at the world and say, does it fit? Everybody does that. Everybody takes what I meet in the world and what the text says and reasons through that to come to a conclusion. Just because it literally says day in Genesis 1 doesn't force us grammatically to be a literal 24-hour day.
Now, you're not taking out, Glenn, that it could mean a literal 24-hour day. The point I think you're making is that there's some that say emphatically it has to be a 24-hour day without any other type of answer or reason behind it. That's the kind of the point you're taking is.
Correct. From the text, it could be a literal 24-hour day. What I'm specifically refuting is this idea that's repeated over and over, is that you can't go out into the world and make observations based on science and bring it back to the text and use that as a tool for interpreting the text. That's what I'm saying. That statement is illegitimate. All of us take things that we know around us, even like principles of grammar are not in the text of Scripture. We have Hebrew grammar, Greek grammar, English grammar, and we use principles of grammar to interpret the text of Scripture. And the principles of grammar are in the grammar book, which is not in the Bible.
So, Glenn, are you saying that Jesus is not a loaf of bread? Whenever he said, "I'm the bread of life," he's not a loaf of bread. Is that what you're saying?
I am saying that when Jesus says, I am the door, that he's not made of wood and has hinges, but he really is the pathway to God. And when he says, I am the light of the world, that he really is the truth, but he's not a photon. When he says, I am the way, he really means he is the way. When he says, this is my body, that it very well could be figurative and not literal. All of hermeneutics is like that. And principles of hermeneutics say you take grammar principles, like the clearer passages are used to interpret the less clear passages. All those are principles of hermeneutics. Anybody that says, oh, I get my Bible interpretation from the Bible, well, how do you get it out in order to form the principles to interpret itself? No, you have to bring in things like grammar and what we know about the world. Hills don't sing, trees don't have hands. And we bring that back to the text to interpret it. So I was just specifically refuting this idea that we can indeed use science and interpret it alongside scripture. Number two, Genesis 1:2 says, quote, the earth was formless and void, unquote. Formless means no form at all. A sphere is a form. If the world was formless, then you can't say it was a sphere. It's really hard to see how you've got a day when there's no spherical earth with rotation. And you could come up with another ad hoc explanation for this, but if we're just looking at what it literally says in Genesis 1:2 is it is formless. And formless means formless. There's no form at all. We can't read into that, well, there's this spherical world and trying to make the days work, when the whole point of the passage is that there was no form. There's none. There's no form to even make a day. The earth did not get any form at all until the third day, which is verses 9 and 10. There's no sphere. There was no land or sea, no separation of earth from heaven, no separation of land from water. So really difficult to get a day on day one if there's no sphere. Point number three, Genesis 1:14. Purely literally, Genesis 1:14 is in the fourth day. And on the fourth day, the day was separated from the night. It says days were created, says that twice in that verse, and the sun was created. People have asked a question about the sun, but what I'm saying is that in Genesis 1:14, on the fourth day, God made days. If we're going to take it purely literally, then we have days before days. That's a major question. Now, there may be an answer to this. I'm not saying there's not. All I'm saying is that it's a legitimate interpretation question, that having days before days gives us some grounds for saying there very possibly could be something else going on here besides six literal 24-hour days. There's room for nothing else but from the textual interpretation that he made days before days. Now, again, you can pull in different things. People say, oh, well, sun's made on the fourth day, so maybe the light came from God in heaven. And okay, well, it didn't say that in the text. Now you're pulling in an ad hoc explanation from outside, and enough of those in a row, and it gets to be what we in Texas would call a kludge, which is you just pile together explanation and it's not systematic. It's really hard to see how there could be evening and morning before days were made and before the day was separated from the night. Yeah, he separated light from dark back on day one, but he didn't separate day from night until day four. It's really hard to see how you've got an evening and a morning with no separation between day and night. Number four, it's hard to see how all the things listed on day six could actually happen in one day. If we look on day six, God created Adam. Adam observed and named all the animals. Adam searched for a helper, and in his search found none amongst the animals. God promised a helper. God put Adam to sleep and made Eve, woke Adam back up. Adam meets Eve and realizes and makes conclusions about her. Just purely, literally from the text, all that happened on day six. It gets a little hard to, that's a lot. Could it be? You can come up with some explanations. It just gets pretty hard. The clues are starting to pile up here that maybe there's more going on here than just a purely literal six 24-hour days. Number five, Genesis 2:4, here day is used in a larger time period. Number six, the first timestamp is at the end of the first day. It says nothing against the beginning of all of this in Genesis 1 and 2. In the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth. When we take the verb there where it says the earth was formless and void, a legitimate Hebrew definition of was is became. You can check the lexicons. It very well could be translated, the earth became formless and void, which gives us some room for more time at that point, a process of time that's possibly there. If we're just going to go purely literally, we have to deal with these questions. Number 7, evening and morning were the first day, second day, third day, could easily be an organizing device for literature. It could very easily fit very well with being a literary organizing device, just to say, here's the first category, here's the second category, here's the third category. Only instead of using the word category, could have used day. Very possible that that's the case. And if you look at what happened on the days, it's all the same types of things. All of the sea and land animals were on one day. All the land animals were on another day. So the categories are divided by the days. Number 8, some young earth creationists have tied the gospel to the age of the earth. I think this is a theological mistake. We would say, as we said in this series, Steve, that the fall, the separation from God, and Adam being a literal person, those are really, really important. But how long ago that happened is of much lesser importance. Not saying it's there may be a right answer here. I'm just saying that how long ago Adam was created is not tied to the gospel. And tying it to the gospel is a New Testament gospel mistake and not an Old Testament Bible mistake. It's taking something that's a minor issue and raising it to the level of the gospel. And I've heard some of these people actually say that people are not Christians, that they've crossed into heresy simply because they believe in an old earth. That's a major gospel mistake. It's a major New Testament doctrinal mistake, tying the age of the earth to the gospel. I can tie the fall to the gospel because Romans 5 ties the fall to the gospel. I can even say, if you're going to say Adam's a figurative literary device, then you got major problems in Romans chapter 5. But if you're talking about age of the earth with the gospel, that's an aberrant view that really needs to go back to systematic theology class, because the age of the earth has nothing to do with the gospel. Number 9, one primary question between old earth and young earth is whether the Bible could doctrinally allow for animal and plant death before Adam's sin. Romans 5 says very clearly that death entered the world through sin. The question is, does that include animal death? If you're saying it does include animal death, then you're forced into a young earth interpretation. If you allow for animal death prior to human separation from God, then there's nothing doctrinally wrong with an older earth or an older creation. If we look at the word death throughout the New Testament, then it's clearly talking about a separation from God at a minimum. And that's the main point of what it's talking about, is a separation from God. Again, just a question. I've seen people on all sides of this issue lift some of these issues up to areas where they shouldn't be lifted. Steve, somebody probably out there accusing us of doing the same thing, because we, at least I, listed separation from God up to the level of orthodoxy and heresy. But some of these other issues, it just seems to me that these questions that we've listed in these last two sessions are fair questions. They're not easy questions. What we're saying in conclusion is that, my Christian brothers and sisters, we need to have some charity amongst people that would disagree with us about how to interpret Genesis 1, 2, and 3.
And as I mentioned before, if you can't listen to somebody else's rebuttal and discuss it with them, you kind of end up closed-minded. Look, I have certain things that I have come to believe based upon scripture, and I'm open to listen to other things. It doesn't mean that I'm going to accept it and change my mind, but I'm at least open to listening to it. I also welcome it so that I can go back and tell the other person, as I noted at the beginning of the session, well, have you considered this? Giving them my view, or at least what I've come to a conclusion with as well. If you don't do that, if we don't have charity with other fellow Christians, we close that door off, then we can't have these discussions amongst us. My point is that there's going to be some things that Christians might disagree on. And I think that's really the point that you're making, Glenn, that doesn't have anything to do with the redemption story or the salvation or God's plan of salvation or how it came about. There are things that Christians can have different views on and still fellowship together. But there are some people that they cut off fellowship. I've had that happen to me in the past over different things that they just cut it off altogether. And all of a sudden, they're not your friends. I don't think that we should be that way amongst Christians.
I'll wrap up with this. There's two categories that we could talk about here. And both these categories are trying to explain the created world. One is theology. Our interpretation of theology tries to explain the world, how the world was made, what's wrong with the world, things like that. Another way of explaining the created world is science. Science looks at the world, does scientific method, does reasoning and interpretation, and tries to explain the created world. Both of them have human beings that interpret both of those things. In one sense, both science and theology trying to do the same things. And in a lot of areas, they agree. If you look at the areas where science and the Bible overlap and agree with each other, it's most things. Scientists in the past, like Kepler and Newton and these guys, these were giants in the scientific world that were faithful people. Newton wrote interpretations and Bible commentaries as well as his science. There's much overlap between the Bible and science. Occasionally, there's some disagreements in area of friction. In both of them, we have to decide as individuals, is my theology right or is my science right? I can tell you, standing here again, I don't claim scientific expertise, but I can tell you from the science that I've observed and the theology I've observed that the times where we've had to change our theology based on the science are very few. There have been some. We explained some in that other session that we talked about earlier, Steve. We had a session on the Bible and science. Nobody now is walking around, at least I haven't met anybody, claiming that the sun is rotating around the earth based off of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We've changed our view of the Bible interpretation. And there's also been times where the science has changed. If we look at how many times theology has changed compared to how many times science has changed, I'll stick with my 4,000, 6,000-year-old theology, thank you very much, and do so happily in the face of the blowing winds of science. Because I have still at my house my book from when I took astronomy as an undergrad back in college. That book in one generation is only good for a doorstop because the science has changed over that quickly. I'll stick with the theology 7 days a week when there's a conflict rather than the science.
We're going to put our approach of charity with fellow Christians in practice as we get into Genesis 1:1, because Glenn, you and I have maybe a little bit of a different view on some of the things in Genesis chapter 1.
We might.
We ask people to tune in and find out about that. But we're still friends. We've been talking about and discussing this for a couple of weeks now, and we're going to continue to be friends.
Yes.
We're fellow Christians, and we're both still going to heaven. We ask you to tune in next time and be with us as what, Glenn?
As we reason through the Bible.
Thank you so much for watching and listening. May God bless you.